Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of My Classic Album, and indeed the first of a new year. I'm Mike Norris, and for the next hour and a half, we're going to be looking back at one of the greatest albums of all time. On this month's episode, we'll be looking back at the Smiths' 1986 album The Queen Is Dead, an album that NME once boasted as the greatest album of all time. My special guest Nathan Stevens-Griffin from Durham-based DIY pop group Martha chose the album himself for this episode of the podcast, and you can hear our chat about the album in just a few minutes. I hope everybody had a really good Christmas. Mine's usually pretty hectic at work, but then once I get home and get into Christmas Day, it's usually pretty chilled and pretty quiet, which is how I like it. Got to spend it with my friends and family, and I hope you had the same pleasure that you were able to see your friends and family over Christmas and exchange gifts and Christmas dinner and all of these things that we do. What's been pretty cool, I mean, the podcast is about 6 months old now. This is obviously episode 6 of My Classic Album, and it's given me a real kind of huge interest in collecting albums on vinyl. So I've always been someone, I'm 30 years old, so vinyl was very much on the outs when I started kind of buying music and getting into music. So I've got hundreds of CDs sitting up in my loft. But it's interesting that when I interview people for My Classic Album, I mean, this is the sixth interview, as I say, the majority of people have brought a copy of the album on vinyl. Not just CD, I mean, some people have, but on vinyl. And, you know, I had a chat with people about that, and they'd said that there's just something about having a copy of it on LP, which is just really special. And I thought it might be quite cool to collect the albums from My Classic Album and have them on LP. So that's what I've been doing. And people have been buying me a lot of albums for Christmas, some that we have covered on the podcast. I got a copy of Revolver on vinyl for Christmas from my sister, which was really cool. But also just albums that I really like. So my favourite album of all time is Bat Out of Hell, which I've said before. And no doubt we will cover that on a future podcast. That's kind of planned in somewhere. And it's nice that my mum actually bought me a copy of that on vinyl for Christmas. I've had it on CD and download and all sorts. But to have a copy of it like that is really cool. What I also got, which was pretty special, and I think they're relatively new. Kiss fans will probably be able to tell me a bit more. I'm a big fan of Kiss. And I'd put on an Amazon wishlist some Kiss albums that I wanted. And one of them that I'd put on, or a few that I'd put on, are the solo albums that they released in the 70s. So for those who don't know, the four members of Kiss all released a solo album on the same day, and it was kind of a battle to see who would top the charts. So Ace Frehley, his album is kind of regarded as the best album, but Gene Simmons is possibly the best selling. I could be wrong there. My mum had bought me a copy of the Gene Simmons album on vinyl for Christmas, and what was really cool is that when I got it out, it was actually a picture disc. So it's the artwork of Gene Simmons' face on the record kind of spinning around as you play it, which is just a really cool gift, really. And so I'd like to thank her very much for that. And if anyone else has got these picture discs, by all means get in touch, because I think they're really cool. Another reason that you might want to get in touch is if you want to appear on the show and talk about your classic album, your favorite album. Now, the past few episodes I've had a lot of musicians kind of coming along and asking that they'd like to talk about the album. Adrian Nation back in December talked about Bob Dylan's Time Out of Mind, and before that Reed Turchie was talking about the Randy Newman album Good Old Boys, and of course Nathan, as I said, is in Martha. But this is a podcast for music fans as well as musicians. So if you've been tempted to kind of send me an email or get in touch because you want to appear on the show, but you feel you're not qualified, there isn't kind of no qualifications about it. As long as you're passionate about the album that you want to talk about, and as long as you're willing to talk about it with me for an extended period of time, that's pretty much all you need to know. I do a lot of research, and the thing is, I've been lucky that the guests that I've had, I've been really knowledgeable and really passionate about the albums that they've picked. So if you think it would be fun to talk about your favourite album on My Classic Album, there's a few ways to get in touch. So if you get yourself on Facebook and you search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris and like the page, you can send me a message or leave something on the wall and just let me know what album you'd like to discuss and why. Alternatively, I've got an Instagram page. So if you go to My Classic Album Podcast, you could send me a direct message or you could tag me in an Instagram post. Again, just talking about your favourite album, and I'll get in touch with you and we'll discuss it a bit. Alternatively, you could go for Twitter, at MCA underscore podcast. Just send me a tweet or a direct message again, and I'll be in touch. Also, if you've been following the social media pages already, you may know that next month's episode is dedicated to Fleetwood Mac's Rumours. Now, the album will be 40 years old in February, so it seemed like a really cool time, rather than just to do a regular episode with a conversation, to bring a few more people in and just see what they think of what is one of the best-selling and most critically acclaimed albums of all time. So if you have any thoughts on Rumours, you can get in touch in the same way, and the best responses will appear on the podcast in February. Right, so now seems as good a time as any to just get started. Nathan Stevens-Griffin from Martha is our special guest on today's episode of My Classic Album. He'll be here in just a moment talking about the Smiths album, The Queen Is Dead. before we get to that conversation, as always, here's just a little fact burst, as I've decided to christen them, the basics about the Queen is Dead. The Queen is Dead is the third studio album from English alternative rock band The Smiths. The album was recorded in winter 1985, according to the liner notes, and was produced by the driving creative force behind the band, guitarist Johnny Marr and the incomparable Morrissey. Rough Trade released the album in the United Kingdom, while Sire Records handled the album's release stateside. Following the band's hugely successful sophomore effort Meet His Murder, the band released single The Boy With The Thorn In His Side on September 23, 1985, ahead of the new album's release. Ultimately, a dispute with Rough Trade meant that The Queen Is Dead wouldn't see release until June 16, 1986. The Boy With The Thorn In His Side reached number 23 in the UK singles charts and boasted the first music video of the band's career. Big Mouth Strikes Again was released shortly before its parent album in May 1986 and reached number 26 in the UK charts. It took until 1992, 5 years after the Smiths had split, for There Is A Light That Never Goes Out to be released as a single, settling in at number 25. As for the album itself, The Queen Is Dead reached number 2 on the UK album charts, while peaking at 70 on the US Billboard 200. The album also charted impressively in the Netherlands, New Zealand and Germany. Critically, the album was hailed as an instant classic, and has come to be regarded as a career highlight for a band that defined the 1980s. Renowned music reviewer Robert Christgau took an instant shine to the album, while Rolling Stone included it on their 500 Greatest Albums of All Time in 2003. The highest praise, however, comes from NME, who in 2013 called The Queen Is Dead the greatest album of all time. So, there's the facts about The Smiths, The Queen Is Dead. And here with me, the person who chose this album, my special guest for this podcast, Mr. Nathan Stevens Griffin. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So, let's just start briefly and discuss why you chose this album, The Queen Is Dead, to discuss here on my classic album.
Okay, so I did have a think about this because I've been listening to the podcast and I know that you always ask this first. And, you know, being a bit of a weirdo, I kind of came up with this pre-prepared answer, but then I kind of was like, no, actually, it should just speak from the heart. So, the honest answer is, you'll probably get people downloading this because they love the Smiths, because Smiths fans are so obsessive and so, you know, very, very, Morrissey fans in particular, very, very, you know, have a lot of love and affection for the artist, and I love the Smiths and I love Morrissey, but I'm not like an obsessive and I'm not someone who has an encyclopedic knowledge or anything like that. So it wasn't the first one to come to my mind.
Yeah.
There were others, things like Talking to the Taxman About Poetry by Billy Bragg, Penis Envy by Crass. I know you're doing one on Rumours, but Rumours is up there, my favourite albums. But this was the one. So I was talking to my friends about it, actually. I was like... What album would you do if you were going to do a podcast? And the one I just kept coming back to was The Smiths, because I got into it. I got into The Smiths when I was a teenager, and it kind of was something that really spoke to me then, as I think a lot of people feel, especially if they're a bit weird. They kind of have that like connection with the lyrics and stuff, and it really spoke to me then. But then it's also one that a lot of the other stuff that I listened to then has kind of fallen away, whereas this one stayed and I've kept coming back to it. So I guess the rambly answer is that it's had the most longevity and it's the one that has, like, you know, always been there throughout my life ever since I first listened to it.
And it's funny because I remember, for people who may not know this, that me and you went to school together, so we're like old friends. I remember that when we discussed it and you came into my work and you'd said, I picked this album, my reaction was, I had a feeling you'd pick The Smiths.
Yeah.
So, like, it's funny to me that you kind of took so long to kind of find it, when for me, there was a part of me that thought, well, he'll probably come out with The Smiths or The Beatles. So
that's really nice to know, actually, because, that's a... Because it was, I thought about The Beatles, you're absolutely right, but I knew you'd done one on The Beatles. And the truth is, I don't really have a favourite album. I have a lot of albums that I love. But, yeah, if there was one I had to talk about for a prolonged period of time, I think this one would be the one.
Yeah. So, in 2013, NME named The Queen Is Dead as the greatest album of all time. So with the exception of Revolver, which we've briefly touched on there, it's probably the only album that we've covered so far on the podcast that's topped such a prestigious poll.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it is about the album that just makes it so not only critically acclaimed, but like loved?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think part of it is that it does that sort of balance and act that is really hard to achieve of being simultaneously very, very mainstream whilst also having the veneer of being obscure.
Mm.
And it's an album that, or like, it's a band in general that appeals to, appeals to people who feel like they're different, people who, you know, feel like they don't fit in. So it has that, like, real emotional connection with people. But also, it is a banging pop album, and it has great songs on it. And it, you know, it's, like, Johnny Marr, I think, used to say that he tried to create pop symphonies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's full of, these, like, three-minute pop symphonies that are, like, so, I don't know, like, diverse, but they're all still within that pop paradigm, so it's very, very accessible.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also high brow, it's funny, it speaks to people emotionally on an individual level, like Morrissey speaking directly to them or about them.
Yeah.
But it's also doing that thing of being like, this is a hegemonic rock album that everyone's heard of. It's not obscure, it's not underground.
Mm.
So it can do that balance, and that's why it topped that NME list as well, I think.
So the band's previous album, Meet His Murder, was released in February 1985, which is an album that actually topped the album charts, which The Queen Is Dead actually didn't manage on that occasion.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see a development in the band's sound between the two albums, or is there something that maybe one's missing, or kind of the differences between them, I guess?
The other thing, which going back to the question about why did I pick this album, was I could have probably picked Meet His Murder or Strange Ways, because it is a toss-up on my mood which of those three are my favourite. But The Queen Is Dead is the one that I think the weird thing about the Smiths is that they were only together for 5 years, and in that time they did 4 albums and God knows how many singles and God knows how much. They just were so prolific and so consistently good that to talk about the development of sound, you're talking about 3-6 months between. So, but I do still feel like there is that what the Queen Is Dead is the Smiths at their very peak, and they're very sort of firing on all cylinders in a songwriting sense. They've got Meet His Murder, I have a personal connection with, and like in the same way, but politically, I guess.
Yeah.
And this, The Queen Is Dead's a bit less, although it is quite political, but it's a bit less overtly preachy, I think, and a bit more like they've made this big political stand and they've topped the charts with it, and now they're just like, right, and here's an album full of cracking tunes, which is political, but it's a more socially acceptable kind of political, I think.
So the Smiths often earn the tag of being a depressing listen, but as you've hit upon, and as I noticed, it's actually a very funny album in places. So in that sense, I'm guessing you'd agree with me that depressing tag is an unjust one.
Yeah, I think the thing I always say whenever anyone says that, because that is a well-worn trope that the Smiths are depressing, is if you've ever been depressed, you probably don't find the Smiths depressing. You find them like comforting. Mm. You find them, what they do is they sing about life and feelings, including sadness, in a very real way. Like, there's a great video on YouTube of Morrissey and Johnny Marr getting interviewed by a bunch of school kids. I can't remember what the show is, but, and they say, like, why are you called the Smiths? You know, where'd you get the band name from? The classic question bands get asked. And he says something like, well, we tried to think of the most ordinary name we could think of, and Smith was the most ordinary name, and we think it's time that the ordinary folks started having their voices heard, or something like that. And I just think that, like, yeah, they're talking about real people with real experiences, and often people's lives aren't, like, I don't know, I don't want to pick a band and like be mean about them, but like, you know, and your other 80s big popular bands are singing about like different things, aren't there? That aren't necessarily as grounded or as mundane.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, the Smiths are a hilarious band. Like, they have really funny lyrics. Mm. Like, it's really witty and acerbic, and like, there's a reason he keeps referring to Oscar Wilde, because he wants to be Oscar Wilde. He wants to be that person. Like, yeah, I think that obviously they have the songs on the album that are so bleak. I Know It's Over is like really, really depressing, I guess. Song about being depressed. Oh, Mother, I Can Feel the Soil Falling Over My Head is the first line of the song. It's about being buried, literally or figuratively. Yeah. But, you know, sometimes if you're feeling that way, and if you've got those dark thoughts, that is what you absolutely want and need to listen to, and that can be a source of great comfort that you're not kind of going through it on your own. So I get a lot more depressed by just really fake stuff, like personally, but you know, I don't want to bash any other kind of music. That's not what I'm here for. May it be positive about the Smiths.
Well, it's funny, it's made me think about when we were talking about Good Old Boys in episode 4 with Reed Turchie, and one of the questions I asked him, which I think very much applies to the Smiths as well, because I think Randy Newman does this as well in his songwriting, is it easier to explore kind of difficult themes and sad themes by injecting a dose of humour? Which I think that both the Smiths and Randy Newman, an odd comparison, but they both do that really well.
No, absolutely, yeah. I think if you look at great art and great artists who have tried to tackle those difficult issues, there's, you know, a gallows humour. It's like, it's part of coping, isn't it? Especially, I think, in Britain. And, like, the Smiths are a very, very British band to a fault. They are very much a northern, you know, like, they're coming from that stiff upper lip sort of, but also kitchen sink drama context of, like, Manchester in the bleak 70s and 80s, and people in Manchester are funny. People in County Durham are funny. That's one of the characteristics of people. They joke about things, and they joke about all kinds of things, including the darker side of life. But yeah, I think humour can be a great sort of political tool as well, a satirical tool, like. There's a lot of that in the album, you know, The Queen Is Dead. Yeah, like, the kind of... So, I don't want to get too, like, facty.
Right.
But, so, did you know...
Right.
..that the original name for the album, the working title... Have you heard this before? You're looking at me.
Yeah.
Well, I'll say it anyway.
Yeah, go for it.
Was Margaret on the Guillotine.
It's because I love it.
Yeah.
I almost wish that was the name.
So, well, actually, Morrissey had a song on his first solo album called Margaret on the Guillotine, which was quite controversial, obviously, and apparently, like, he was interviewed by Scotland Yard over it and stuff, but it was a bit too full on, I guess, for this album. But yeah, like, that's deeply political, but it's also very tongue-in-cheek. I don't think he's really, or maybe he is, you know what he's like, but I don't think he's really saying that the Queen should be hung. Like, you know, I don't think he's really saying we should hang the Queen, but he's presenting a critique of the monarchy, isn't he? And like, that kind of unearned privilege from a working class perspective. So, yeah, to go back to your question, humour is a great tool for dealing with sad and difficult issues.
So, as I was kind of looking into the album, I found a really, really interesting article on thequietest.com by a gentleman called Simon Price, who professes at the start that he's been a lifelong fan of the Smiths. And he wrote this, as I say, this really interesting article about the album turning 30 back in June.
Cool.
And he suggested that the big difference between this album and Meter's Murder, as we've discussed, is maybe the humour. There's a lot more humour on The Queen Is Dead. The crux of his article, basically, and I'm going to I'm going to revisit it throughout our chat because I just read it and I'm not 100% I agree with him here, but it was just really, I thought, that's definitely worth talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The crux being that The Queen is Dead isn't their best work because of the way that the mainstream latched onto it, as we've spoke about.
Mm-hmm.
And he, just a little quote here from him, he called the album an aggravatingly inconsistent listening experience.
Right, okay.
So I'm just going to keep touching back on that because there's certain songs in particular that he kind of highlights, and I'm sure you can probably guess those songs already. I do think as well, though, there's always a bit of aggravation when it's kind of your band goes stratospheric.
Yeah.
So, like, I've got bands that I love, and as you watch them kind of, you know, you maybe see them in some dingy club in the middle of Newcastle,
mm-hmm.
and then as time goes on, all of a sudden they're doing arenas and stadiums, and you're like, but that they were my band, what happened? Yeah. And you're happy for them, but at the same time, there's this little bit of ill will, because you're like, well, you were my band, and now I've got to share you with everybody.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's a bit of it, but we'll... Obviously, I am going to keep touching back on Simon Price.
No, that's interesting as well, because, like, as I say, it was a toss-up between Meter's Murder,
mm-hmm.
between The Queen is Dead, and between Strange Ways, the last album, Strange Ways, Here We Come. And, yeah, there's always that... there are points in the album, there are tracks that aren't my favourite Smith songs.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say... What was it? Maddlingly inconsistent or something.
An aggravatingly inconsistent listening experience.
I think that's BS, but yeah, especially with the Smiths, and if you were there at the time, it must have been something to kind of get used to. But yeah, I think like part of the reason I picked it is because it is so widely acknowledged to be a great album, and I agree with that. I think it's deserved. It's an amazing collection of songs.
Mm.
There are high points and low points, but yeah.
We'd have that with any album, I guess.
I think so. I probably could have picked an album if I'd really put my mind to it, where I'm like, every song's a complete 100% banger. But it maybe wouldn't have been one anyone would have heard of, so it wouldn't have made a good podcast.
So, in previous episodes, we've looked at albums boasting great songwriters. So talking mm-hmm. Lennon, McCartney, Randy Newman, Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Surely Morrissey must be part of that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, he must be. And I think it's something to do with, as you've touched on, how relatable the lyrics are.
Yeah.
So, I've got a quote here from Morrissey, which I think it's interesting because, like I say, you introduced me to the Smiths as a teenager. And they're not a band that I've particularly latched onto massively throughout mm-hmm. my life, but they are a band that I often come back to and listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And this quote from Morrissey to Q magazine made me kind of think a bit more about what it is about his lyrics, and it kind of made me understand him a bit more. So he said, "I never enjoyed life in my 20s, not one minute of it. It was a test of endurance that I'm surprised I survived. Professionally, of course, I was doing very well, but personally, it couldn't have been worse or more difficult for me if I'd been living in a mud hut in Leeds."
Mm-hmm.
And I think, funnily enough, we were having this conversation before we even started recording, that everybody seems to have this moment in their 20s where they wonder where their life is going. Mm-hmm. And it's like you wake up and you're like, I'm not where I expected to be, you know, and it depends what you measure it on. We were talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's a whole new way to, for me personally, to relate to Morrissey's words on Smith's albums, because he was in his 20s when he's recording them. So he's having this real difficult time,
mm-hmm.
despite being top of the album charts, touring in this really critically acclaimed band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's spoken a lot about how depressed he was when he was in the Smiths. I think sometimes there's quite a reductive narrative around mental illness as this, like, that really romanticises it and says, oh, you know, like, it, thanks to people being depressed, we get great art, and, you know, Sylvia Plath, and, like, Morrissey probably fits into that category a little bit, but I think we need to be wary of that kind of thing, because that isn't everyone's experience, and, you know. But I do think that, like, his problems, his mental illness, his mental health problems, or just his experiences and his dissatisfaction comes through so much in the Smiths' lyrics, that he's this young, attractive, deeply weird, deeply unhappy guy who is kind of hilarious. Everyone wants to be his friend, but he's constantly talking about being lonely and, like, having no one. People are throwing themselves all over him, but he's like, he's this, like, I really think there's, like, no one like him.
Mm.
There's no one creatively, you know, that I can think of in the world who is like him.
Yeah.
For better or worse, he's a unique figure. Like, in recent years, especially, and when he was younger, he says things I completely disagree with all the time.
Yeah.
Politically and otherwise. He's not someone who I am a disciple of, but as a sort of creative figure, as a lyricist, he's absolutely my idol. He's someone who I aspire to, if I can get anywhere near to writing lyrics in my own sort of musical projects, they're anywhere near as good as his, anywhere near as funny but meaningful and like so rich and thick with meaning. Like, every song has so many layers to it, and well, not every song, but you know, when it's a great song, there's so much to it.
Yeah,
I just think he absolutely has to be in that conversation, and he is, like, he is. He's not someone who is underrated or like he does get his fair share of the pie, but he'd probably act like he doesn't. I know he's mourning recently that he wasn't in the Hall of Fame or something, but that's kind of his crack these days, is just say something controversial every few months and sell some records off the back of it. But yeah, I think he's absolutely a genius. 100%. So is Johnny Marr.
So now seems as good a time as any to go track by track.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll start with the title track, The Queen Is Dead.
Yeah.
The song, and indeed the album, begins with a sample from the film The L-Shaped Room.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the characters singing Take Me Back to Dear Old Blighty.
Yeah.
And then that leads into this kind of like high-pitched sort of feedback, and then it settles into the song.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I can gather, these were two separate ideas. So Morrissey obviously had the idea of the sample. Johnny Marr had the idea of the feedback leading into the song. But they do kind of just naturally just come together really nice.
Yeah, it's like yeah, Morrissey was and still is sort of obsessed with that kind of kitchen sink realism of like real British or, you know, real working class lives that he saw as being completely absent from the narrative. So there's that quote by Oscar Wilde, I'll get it wrong, but it's something like talent borrows, genius steals. And he, I think they inscribed that on one of their singles.
Right.
He stole from everywhere, and a big place that he stole from was these kind of dramas, these drama films. And so I guess like using that sample is going to be him setting up the, because like I can't claim to have seen the L-Shaped Room. I've seen a couple of the more well-known ones, Taste of Honey and Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, that he, you know, if you watch them, you hear Smith's lyrics all the way through, you're like, he's nicked that from there. There's so many examples, it's really funny. But the genius is the way that he turns them into, he puts them into songs and he puts them against this great music. I'd be fascinated to know more about the songwriting process, because from what I understand it, Johnny Marr would just create a song and give it to Morrissey on a tape, post it through his letterbox, and then he'd like put it on and just walk over the top of it and figure it out. And then, but yeah, it's like that sort of bipolarity of that songwriting where you've got the feedback idea and then we're having a sample from a 60s like drama. It's an interesting clash of sort of things, but it's really good.
So if we were to combine the lyrics of the song with the Dear Old Blighty intro, do you interpret the song as an attack on 1980s Britain beyond the monarchy? Because obviously there's a lot about the monarchy in there.
Yeah, I think it's chiefly a song, an anti-establishment song, that's how I view it. It's about privilege, unjustified privilege. He saw it as deeply offensive that the monarchy still exists, as a lot of people did and do. This song for me is more powerful than God Save the Queen by the Pistols.
Yeah.
It's a more powerful indictment because instead of being a sarcastic, like hyperbolic song, the fascist regime or whatever, which at the time was incredibly powerful, banned from the radio, this attacks the monarchy and the British establishment in a completely different way, in a much weirder way that's kind of like indirect and like...
But I'd argue it's almost a more British way as well.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a very much like... It's not sarcastic, but it is funny.
Yeah.
So there's the line about, so I broke into the palace with a sponge and a rusty hammer. Also, I'll get the lyrics wrong, but you know what it's. I broke into the palace with a sponge and a rusty hammer. She said, I know you and you cannot sing. I said, that's nothing, you should hear me play a piano. Which is a brilliant rhyming couplet, yeah. Rhyming, you know, spanner and piano. Like, yeah. But he's talking about, like, breaking into the palace to kill the queen and presumably clean up the mess with the sponge.
And again, you get this, like, I can see this image of Morrissey kind of climbing through the window with his spanner and his sponge, and the queen just being like, oh, I know you. Yeah. Like, so it's really like, I think that's, oh, yeah.
And there's also the line, and we haven't touched on this yet, and one of the things that I really appeals to me about the lyrics of the Smiths, and did especially when I was a teenager, is there's this whole sort of queer element to it. Morrissey is that indefinable. He was constantly asked about his sexuality and he constantly refused to answer. People said, you know, are you gay? Are you? And he'd just say, I'm nothing. He said, I'm asexual. There's the line is like, I can't remember the actual lyric, but he's talking about tracing his family tree back. And he's like, I was descended from some old queen or other. And what he means is, queen is in terms of the gay slang.
Yeah.
And he's talking about his own, you know, he's never described himself as bisexual, but he's since sort of come out and talked about same-sex relationships that he's had and stuff like that. And there's that's kind of like in the subtext of a lot of his songwriting that maybe the sort of the indie boys don't really notice or see, but a lot of this is very homoerotic, or as Morrissey would say, erotic, mm-hmm. because you never hear about things being heteroerotic.
Yeah.
So he just, you know, for him, there's all kinds of things going on with his sexuality. He talks about being celibate, asexual at the time, but he's also acknowledging that he's got this queerness to him, which I identify with a lot, that mm-hmm. I have that as well, that I'm not a heterosexual person. I'm a bit heterosexual, but I'm a bit something else as well. So that really is kind of something that has always, that I've come to terms with over the years. But there's something that when I was a teenager, it was like, that was always then in the front of the albums with the dudes with the tops off all the time and stuff like this. That's like, there's always that sort of queerness to the music that I think is like, can't remember how we got onto that, but yeah, that, you know, the sort of buried, really, the intertextuality of it all, and the really sort of, if you study the lyrics closely,
mm-hmm.
I'm really bad at remembering lyrics. This is the ironic thing about me coming on a podcast and talking about lyrics, but yeah, if you study them closely, you can find so much in them. You can find so many, like, Easter eggs in the lyrics that are, like, really cool. So, yeah.
But then I think musically, it's a really great track as well. And as we kind of said before we start going track by track, it's so easy to get lost in Morrissey and talk about Morrissey and his lyrics the whole time and Johnny Marr. But, I mean, like, the drums on this song.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely. Mike Joyce on drums. It's just totally, it totally powers the song forward.
Absolutely brilliant. And, like, another tidbit fact. So, as I understand it, the intro to that, the dum 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 dum, like the intro tom bit, is a sample that's been looped. They, you know, built on top of, and then so he played it, and they just cut that bit out and then looped it, and then he went and learned it. So when they did it live, he had to do this ridiculous like sampled tom intro, but he actually like was that good of a drummer that he actually just was like, all right, I'll do that live, and just kind of learnt this mechanical sampled version of the drum intro. It's a great song musically. You're absolutely right. It's a banger. Mm-hmm. It is like absolutely a barnstormer of an album opener. Like,
yeah.
And yeah, that's very much to do with the rhythm section as well as the sort of guitars and lyrics and stuff like that.
So track two, Frankly, Mr. Shankly.
Yeah.
Now, it's essentially a huge change from The Queen Is Dead. You've gone from this real kind of barnstormer, and this is almost kind of more jingly jangly, it's supposedly a dig at Rough Trade Records head Jeff Travis.
All right, okay.
So Travis himself has called it a funny lyric about Morrissey's desire to be somewhere else. Right, but he does acknowledge that the line about silly poetry alludes to a poem that he once wrote for Morrissey.
Right, okay.
So, again, I don't think he's too offended by it, but he doesn't tend to necessarily acknowledge that that's in fact.
See, that's interesting, because that's so my interpretation of that song, and it, again, it's going back to the politics, but the more funny and less preachy politics, is that it's a song about having a terrible boss, and like having someone that almost everyone can probably relate to at some point in their lives. They've been working and they've had someone above them who is like incompetent or not fit in their eyes to be telling them what to do. And that's who Mr. Shankly is in the song.
Yeah.
Again, we were talking before the podcast, but we were talking about how growing up and sort of when you get into the world of having a job and like, work, and it's really hard to stay creative and keep the energy going about the things that you really care about, and be that, making a podcast or making music or whatever your outlet is, painting, dominoes, whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's really hard to find that energy because you expel it all in this work that you sort of, and that like the line, like, I want to leave, you will not miss me. I want to go down in musical history is like, for me, that speaks to me a lot, because it's like there's been times in my life, not now, I should add, but times in my life where I've been working, where I've been like, I don't want to be doing this, I want to be playing music. Mm. Like, I do like my current job, but if I could do it for a living, then I would do music. And like, there's kind of, you could almost say there's like a sort of Marxist element to it, although he probably wouldn't say that, but like, that it's about people who are stuck in jobs, and in the context of the song before, there's these really rich people who've been born into privilege, and then the next song is about these people toiling away with these bosses who are above them and who are incompetent and all the rest. I'm going to give you one fun fact about this song.
Cool.
You've been thrown
some I'm enjoying the fun fact.
So the line, sometimes I'd feel more fulfilled writing Christmas cards with a mentally ill, is widely believed to be a reference to a Victoria Wood song.
Right.
So at that point, it's weird, isn't it? Victoria Wood at that point is a stand-up who does funny songs. And she has a song called Funny How Things Turn Out. Again, it's like, talent borrows, genius steals. He's just stolen that from Victoria Wood. But that's it. He likes these working class women often. People, lyricists, playwrights, comedians. His favourite show is Coronation Street. Morrissey still watches Coronation Street.
Mm.
It's about real people with real lives, working class people. Yeah, I love that song. It's funny, it's bouncy, it's a great song.
Well, Simon Price of thequietest.com
does not like it.
Does not a fan of,
well,
frankly, Mr. Shankly.
He can get on his mic.
So I'm going to read you a quote about it. So he says, following The Queen is Dead with frankly Mr. Shankly is like releasing Citizen Kane on a double bill with Sex Lives of the Potato Men. Frankly, Mr. Shankly, with its jocular rum-ti-tum melody and umpa bassline, is so outlandishly appalling that it deserves to be the subject of a public inquiry. It is the Smiths' worst ever song.
Well, I respectfully disagree with that. I absolutely love it. But yeah, that's the beauty of this kind of thing.
Everyone's totally
entitled to their opinion. But yeah, I think it's hilarious, and it's what the song, the album, we'll get onto the third song, but the album, you go through emotional whiplash with the first three songs. Mm. It's like you're dragged in all directions.
Yeah.
But yeah, it absolutely needs that levity. You just had the first song is funny, but it's like, it takes you to a different place. The album keeps taking you to different places. That's why I love it.
So I hope you're enjoying my conversation so far with Nathan Stevens Griffin about the Smiths' fantastic 1986 album, The Queen is Dead. Nathan and I will pick up where we left off in just a little bit, and you can find out which song on the album Nathan thinks is the greatest pop song of all time. Plus, is there a greater message beyond the humour of the brilliantly titled Vicar in a Tutu? All that and more coming up after this. On the 4th of February 2017, Fleetwood Mac's classic album Rumours will be 40 years old. To celebrate, My Classic Album will be looking back at this iconic album in full in our February episode. Do you have any special memories or moments attached to this album?
Maybe you were lucky enough to see the band on tour around that time. Or perhaps the songs had a particular resonance to you at a particular point in your life. Share your story with me and they can make their way onto our special episode, 40 Years of Rumours. Want to get involved? Simply send a message to our Facebook page, My Classic Album with Mike Norris. Message our Instagram account, My Classic Album Podcast, or tweet us at MCA_podcast for more information.
So we'll move on to I Know It's Over.
Mm-hmm.
So bass player Andy Rourke, who incidentally, I must say that I love the bass in this song. So again, we're kind of, you know.
Yeah.
He said the following to NME about the album. The song.
Yeah.
Dark and deep. We did it with the lights turned down low, everybody getting into it. There was beer and whatever else, lots of spliff going down. It's really like a lights off, headphones late at night kind of song. It's really dreamy. I'd say definitely it's one of my favourites on the album. Mm-hmm. I'd go that far.
Yeah, I think it is absolutely savage.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is, it's heavier than a lot of very heavy music.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a song about being deeply, existentially lonely and isolated. And this is coming from someone who's just, the album before this has topped the charts and is on top of the pops, and you know, on he's profoundly depressed, or he's doing a very good job of writing from that perspective. And you know, there's allusions to suicide, like the knife that wants to slit me he's talking about, and it's really, really dark, but it is, and to have it as the third track on the album is, for me, it's a really baller move to do that, to be like, let's have The Queen Is Dead, which is like this sort of post-punk, almost like pummeling banger.
Mm.
And then the Rumpty Tum, Frankly Mr. Shankly. And then going to like probably the saddest Smiths song ever from a band that write a lot of sad songs. And it, you know, I think that is a, that's a pretty cool move that they were like, no, that's going to, the received wisdom will be track 10.
Mm.
Maybe track 9 and then have something at the end to cheer people up, but they're like, nah, number 3. You're having that third and you're gonna...
Yeah.
And it's like, it's long as well. It's like musically it's beautiful, but yeah, if you sort of even paying cursory attention to the lyrics, it's a really sad song.
Yeah.
Like, but yeah, we need sad songs, don't we?
And I guess that's it. We've had this discussion a little bit, and we've talked about on other episodes of the podcast about whether sad songs are depressing, they give you hope. And we've touched on this. You know, probably the most, I don't want to say mainstream, but the most possibly well-known popular example is Everybody Hurts by REM.
Yeah.
That kind of people listen to Everybody Hurts, and if you don't really listen to it, God, what a depressing song this is. Yeah. Everybody Hurts. Good God. But I found, and again, I discussed this in previous episodes, that my kind of relationship with mental health, that I listen to a song like Everybody Hurts or No Surprises by Radiohead, and it's kind of, I take something from it. It gives you hope, because it is that idea that you're not alone. So kind of the idea that Morrissey really wears his heart on his sleeve in this song, and it is possibly the saddest song on the album, if not in their entire back catalogue, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a depressing song.
I think that, yeah, I completely agree with you. There's a line, obviously, and like, you do have to look after, you know, if you are someone who experiences mental health issues, you have to be proactive and look after yourself and not wallow, like try not to wallow. But sometimes you just need that. You need to like have that outlet in terms of if you're a music lover or someone who's like, or watching a sad film or whatever, like, you need, this is why art exists. It doesn't have like a, it's not functional like a couch or like a laptop. It's ephemeral, and you know, but songs like that do have a function in the sense that they provide solace. Or like the interesting, the difference between Everybody Hurts and this song is that Everybody Hurts, I completely agree, is a song which does, it does have that lyrical, you know, you're not alone in this, everybody goes through this, and you know, the subtext, it'll get better. This is like, no, I'm in the grave and the soil's on top of me, and like, yeah, it's just, you know, very, very bleak, but we do need that sometimes, I think. Yeah. Not everyone, and you know, no one should be forced to listen to the Smiths. But if you're of a happy disposition, then maybe don't listen to the song, because maybe it's the thing that'll tip you into the... But for me, and for my background and my like history with that kind of stuff, it's provided all kinds of solace and help, so yeah.
So the next track on the album is Never Had No One Ever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's not actually a huge amount out there about this song. Mm-hmm.
This was the one that I thought that Young Fella Me Lad would... That would have been one of the low points, I would have thought. Was it one of his, or...?
No.
Okay, no. That's interesting. This is a sort of... The Smiths don't really have bad songs, as far as I'm concerned, but this song is the sort of... This is the album just in its flow. I wouldn't say it's filler, but it is just... It is a simple song. And following on from I Know It's Over, and, you know... Before Cemetery Gates, which we'll get on to, it is very hard to stand out. It is a, you know, it. The thing that I think I like about the song, and I wouldn't skip any song in this album, but the thing that I like about it is its atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
It's an atmospheric song, and it takes you to a place, and like you sit there for a while, and you kind of live in it, and then you move on, and that's like. Music that's more to do with the music than the lyrics, and I like, as you probably gathered, I'm mainly the thing that really for me about the Smiths, although I love the music, the thing for me is the lyrics. So, and this is a song with, you know, not many lyrics. It isn't one of his high points lyrically.
It does have this kind of like murky, almost eerie kind of sound to it, and then towards the end of the song Morrissey's kind of heard laughing, which again adds to that kind of feeling. Allegedly, that's due to one too many shandies in the studio, is what I was reading. But it is pretty jarring when you pair it with the lyrics as well. Like I say, Never Had No One Ever, and then this laughing at the end. It's very kind of...
Yeah.
And the way it kind of sits in between these two tracks, it is almost kind of, it's giving you almost a chance to kind of breathe. It's like, you know, you've had, you know, this song that's really kind of taken you to this other place, and then you've got Cemetery Gates coming up, and it's just kind of a bit of time to breathe, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, like, like, that for me is a... When you said that that it was mad, whatever, inconsistent, I thought, oh, well, you know, there's a couple of songs that don't have too much to them and don't have too much about them. And, like, you certainly can't say that about Frankly, Mr. Shankly. It's a song that has an identity.
So Cemetery Gates follows straight after that. So musically, this is kind of a lift in pace and mood.
Yeah.
Now, we've talked a lot about Morrissey and plagiarism and stuff.
Yeah.
So this song's quite ironic in some ways.
Yeah, it's meta. That's what it is.
Yeah. This idea that Morrissey's speaking out against plagiarism. And obviously it's almost like an ode to Oscar Wilde as well, isn't it?
Yeah,
as you've said throughout, he's known from kind of from 60s dramas to Victoria Wood to Oscar Wilde, just going, oh, I love that. That sounds fun. But would you kind of agree with the sentiment of the song? And
yeah, well, it's almost too clever for its own good, the song, because it is... He's inhabiting the position of someone who's very self-righteous and saying, now you shouldn't plagiarise, but he's actually plagiarised almost every line of the song. The whole song is quotes from things that he's nicked, and I'm sure it was somewhere out there on the internet or, you know, in some book somewhere, someone's systematically gone through every line, but that's the beauty of it, and that is the genius of it. Like, he is... This was my... When I was at school, this was my favourite Smith song. And it's still up there. But I think the reason I liked it then was because it's clever. And, you know, I got a sense of, oh, well, you know, I kind of get the joke, or, like, I'm in on it. But, it's like... And I love songs that are stories. And, like, there's lots of... You know, lots of examples, but this is one. You got two young people, presumably, who are like dicking around in a cemetery, which is perfect for my sort of mental state as a teenager. Yes, please, let's go and mess around in a cemetery. And they're quoting poetry to one another, and they're kind of going, "No, you've nicked that off," and being able to name. And it's like these two absolute, probably insufferable people if you ever met them, but it's a romantic story about these like two complete weirdos in this like these complete outsiders were like, oh god, it's sunny outside, like, we have to offset this, so let's go to the cemetery and, like, look at the graves and, like, quote poetry and try and, like, trip each other up. Like, yeah, the funny thing about it as well is that you've got all this, like, plagiarism and then also, like, moralizing about plagiarism, but you've also got the fact that he spelt cemetery wrong.
Yeah.
Which is, like, and I'm like, that must be deliberate. But when I've looked into it, it seems like it wasn't. And no, and people, like, at that point, people surrounding Morrissey were just like, no, we have to do exactly how he writes it, and maybe assumed it was some, like, ye olde English way of spelling cemetery or something. But it's just, like, a typo in the middle there as well. Yeah. It's, like, this weird, like, inconsistency. But, yeah, it's, like, a song about not copying that's completely copied. And I love that.
So Johnny Marr said to Enemy, I did this in my kitchen with Morrissey. When I played it, I wasn't sure about it, but that's one example of how a partnership works, because Morrissey loved it and it came so effortlessly and easy, I was just about to bin it.
Wow.
But again, it's just when you've got these two songs that are admittedly kind of melancholy and such, and then this just brings you back up. Yeah, so is that what you're talking about? This kind of movement of it drags you one way and drags you another, and it never... When we were talking about Bob Dylan, Time Out of Mind, it's the idea, the first half of that album, I don't know if you've listened to it, is very much like, it starts pretty down, and then it goes down and down and down. And like, you can tell that the protagonist in the album is just really struggling with things until you get to about halfway through the album where things start to kind of brighten up a bit. But here, you kind of here, you're there, you're here, which is just a lot of fun.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely, and it's like, in a way... You know, it's the kind of quintessential indie pop song, isn't it? It's like the jangly, but with the the sort of, the like tight rhythm section underneath, and the like very like intellectually sort of smart ass lyrics, and like it has that. It kind of is like a probably served as a kind of formula for a lot of music that came after it, but that didn't quite do it as well.
Yeah,
but yeah, like. You by this point in the album, you've been a lot of places.
Yeah. Big Mouth Strikes Again is next. Now, this is one of two singles from the album in kind of its... When the album was released in the 80s, there were a couple of other songs released kind of later. So, from what I can gather, it's a song about the protagonist's frustration by being attacked by his comments.
Yeah.
So, as outspoken as he is, do we think this is somewhat autobiographical? Do we think it's exploring Morrissey's frustrations at being in the public eye?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's about how, even at that point, and, like, goodness me, there was a hell of a lot more controversy to come, like, in years to follow. You know, if you're still doing this in 10 years, I'll come back and I'll do, we'll do Vauxhall and I, or Your Arsenal, or one of the Morrissey solo albums, but... Yeah, like, he's generated so much controversy, and this is part of the difference between me and Morrissey in terms of how mental health impacts us, is that he clearly just speaks his mind constantly, and he just says what he feels, and then he gets pilloried for it. And rightly so, a lot of the time. He does, like, especially in recent years, he's turned into a bit of a bigot in some ways, and he's saying some... things I completely disagree with.
Yeah.
But back then, he was this figure who'd be... He didn't see himself as... And he isn't a politician. He isn't, like, holding office. He's just a guy who writes songs who people ask questions and he answers them. And it's at a time... It's, like, the height of Thatcher. It's the height of Reagan. It's the fakest time in human history. It's sort of... like, shoulder pads and, like, cocaine and, like, yuppies and, like, American Psycho. And he's just there and he's, like, being honest and being truthful about things. And every time he opens his mouth, he says something that he later thinks, oh, God, who ever said that? And, like, the press go wild. And, you know, that's what the song's about. That is him. It's about him. As far as I can see, it's about him constantly putting his foot in his mouth, but also feeling like a lot of the sort of response is unjustified and over the top. Like,
but it's even the idea of kind of comparing yourself to Joan of Arc. This, now I know how Joan of Arc felt.
Yeah, as a martyr.
That's the exact sort of thing that Morrissey detractors would be like, oh, Like, do you know what I mean? Like, there he is. So I guess in that sense, even that made me think, this has got to be somewhat autobiographical, because it just, kind of, I mean, obviously I know he writes all the songs, but it just reeked of Morrissey. Totally.
But it's also, like, if, you know, I appreciate that. If anyone's got this far into listening and hates Morrissey, well done. Because I appreciate that Morrissey is a divisive figure and he's not for everyone. And I'm sure I'm not for everyone. And maybe you're not for everyone. Totally. But I think you are for everyone.
Oh, thank you.
But yeah, like, anyone who listens to that can surely say, you know, that this is someone with his tongue firmly in his cheek when he's right. And he is, like, it's funny.
Yeah.
It's a funny song about someone who's being burnt at the stake for what they've done or said, him specifically. Do you want another tidbit?
Go for it.
So the high-pitched vocals in it were originally sung by Kirsty MacColl, but Johnny Marr, when it was finished, Johnny Marr thought it sounded weird, so they took one of Morrissey's vocal tracks and just pitch shifted it. And apparently it sounded so funny on its own that Morrissey was like rolling around laughing on the floor, which is this image that is hard to actually like comprehend, although from what you said it sounds like they did have a good laugh making the album. But yeah, like, it's actually a pitch shifted Morrissey vocal track, and they listed it on the album as "And Coates" in the back and vocals.
Yeah,
but you know, it wasn't "And Coates," it was Morrissey.
So, as we've said, the song was released as a single directly before the album's release, and it reached number 26 on the UK singles charts. Johnny Marr called it their Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Right, yeah.
So, for anyone new at the Smiths, is this like a good start, for like a good introduction to the band?
Yeah, because that is a difficult question as well, is like, where do you start with the Smiths?
Mm-hmm.
Like, other than, you know, the obvious Panic or This Charming Man or whatever. But I would say this is a good song, yes, to your question. But I think the thing is, with the Smiths, you can start almost anywhere, and if you like it, you like it, and if you don't, you don't, because they're not a band, you know, as compared to The Cure or someone else from a similar era who, great band, great songs, and when The Cure were on form, they very much were on form. But when they weren't, they really weren't.
Yeah.
Whereas the Smiths was so consistent in that classic Burn Brightly thing. They were like someone had lit a match and just whoosh, and then they've gone and that's it. And like, okay, no more Smiths. And they're still sort of taunting us with a reunion, but maybe that wouldn't be a good thing. But yeah, like they you can start anywhere, I think, and get a good idea. I started with, I bought, when there used to be CD shops in towns, record stores, I bought the self-titled first album from Concepts.
Yeah.
In Durham, RIP.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that starts with Reel Around the Fountain, which is a song that many people think is about child abuse. It's like this really like maudlin, like dirge of a song.
Mm.
And I'd say that's like the worst place to start, maybe, is their first album. Maybe there's people listening that were kicking off, but like, yeah, but still, I was like, okay, this is weird, but I'm going to stick with it. I think you can start almost anywhere and kind of get an idea of whether you'll like it or not.
Yeah. And it's funny because, coincidentally, the first Smith song I ever heard was The Boy with the Thorn in His Side, which is the next track.
Yeah.
So it's very likely that you introduced me to this song and indeed to the band.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it takes me back to my teenage years of it's discovering Smith. I think you even bought me a Morrissey album for Christmas one Christmas, as I recall. So I'd say this is one of, if not my favourite on the album. Yeah, it's a difficult thing, but I always try and identify a favourite if I can.
It's Morrissey's favourite Smith song.
Right.
Yeah. So you're in good company.
So this was, the recording was originally intended as a demo,
yeah,
but the band felt it was good enough to release as a single. I mean, this was released a good 9 months before The Queen Is Dead even came out.
Right, yeah.
On the 16th of September 1985.
Right.
The album had like an alternate mix on it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard like both versions? Is there much difference between them? Or
I don't know, actually. I'm trying to think, is one of them on Hatful of Hollow or something? Or
possibly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've not heard, at least I don't think I've heard both versions.
This is where, you know, as the disclaimer I gave at the beginning, I'm not like an encyclopedic Smiths guy. I do love the Smiths, but they're one of those bands where if you're really into the Smiths, the bar's set so high that you have to be like, you know, it's a full-time job really to kind of be a Smiths enthusiast.
It's a bit like Queen. I mean, you know, I'm a massive Queen fan, and it's like there's so much out there about Queen. And it's like you say, it's a full-time job. I must have read so many books over the years about the history of the band and all sorts of things.
But yes, it's possible, like, you know, I'm showing my lack of knowledge here, but yeah, I know that. So that there's this sort of collection, Hatful of Hollow, that has a different version of This Charming Man on it, and a lot of them are like Peel sessions and stuff that they kind of collected. And yeah, like, I do like listening to the sort of alternate versions every now and again. It's it's cool, like, to get that, because it's like, especially the Peel session ones, they're all stripped back because it's just the four of them live playing. So you don't have all the, like, Johnny Marr used to layer and layer and layer guitars and acoustic guitars and all kinds of things on top of each other, so you get that symphonic, like, sound. But yeah, The Boy with the Thorn Inside, great song.
There's a lot of discussion that the song is about Morrissey's relationship with the music industry. So with that in mind, he is the boy with the thorn in his side. So Morrissey was on Channel 4's The Tube at the time the song was released, and he said that the thorn is the music industry, and all those people who never believed anything I said tried to get rid of me and wouldn't play the records. So I think we've reached a stage where we feel, if they don't believe me now, will they ever believe me? What more can a poor boy do?
Yeah. And like, that's it, isn't it? Because he's always been aggrieved. Like, at the time, he would constantly talk about how they didn't get their rub of the green and they weren't played on the radio enough and stuff like this. And like, that's probably true. Like, the stuff that was getting played was very trashy, disposable stuff in the mid-80s. And they weren't getting the what they deserved, or what he felt that they deserved. And so he's like, you know, that's the sort of chip on his shoulder, of the thorn in his side, is that they exist in this but then at the same time, they obviously they compromised because they wanted to be huge, they wanted to be big. They weren't a band who was like, well, we don't care if the mainstream doesn't accept us. They were a band who were like, why hasn't the mainstream, like, completely got behind us? Like, and it's like I was saying at the beginning, that simultaneously being outsiders and also insiders, like, they had a level of fame and adulation that most bands can only dream of. Vast majority of bands can only, you know, in their wildest dreams think about. And still, Morrissey is like, no, we didn't get our fair share. We should have been number one every time. We should have. Which it may be great artists need that kind of, whatever the opposite of humility is, hubris.
So the song, in some ways, are going to be split in half, where Morrissey's using the pronoun me in the first half and us in the second half. So again, do you think if me is relating to Morrissey, does us relate to musicians in general?
Yeah, maybe, or just maybe the sort of, maybe the band, or the kind of the outsiders. That he's like the unheard voices, the Smiths of the world, the ordinary people who are being ignored by this, you know, sort of Thatcherite, neoliberal, whatever. Not that he would put it in those terms, but this kind of consumerist, this burgeoning consumerist society that's so facile and vapid, and he's the real people are being ignored. But yeah, like, this was like, I understand this, the first time they did a music video. And in the past, he'd gone on and on about how he thought music videos were like rubbish, and like, it should just be the record, and you shouldn't like pollute it with this other nonsense. It's like trivial. We just want the record. But then they're like, actually, we only got to number 26 with that single, so Morrissey, could you do a music video? Like, and they're like, right, okay, so there is some compromise there, isn't there? They're accepting, but they're also, it's meta, and it's a song that's about the music industry that is part of the music industry, and like, they have that self-awareness as well. But it's also just a very nice song, I think. Catchy song that, like, that's probably, you know, why I like it. More than anything else.
Oh, totally. I mean, I guess when I was a 14, 15 year old, I didn't really think about the context of the song. I just liked it.
Yeah, so. Exactly. It, and that could also be a good intro point, I think, for someone who's never heard them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Vicar in a Tutu is next.
Is this one of your lads?
It is. It is. Okay. Now, I'm keeping track of my favourite song titles as we cover albums, yeah. And Vicar in a Tutu is right up there.
Yeah.
So, it's another humorous song in the vein of Mr. Shankly.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much when you know, there's not much kind of interpretation going on here. It's just, it's a cross-dressing vicar, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, so. I can get deep on this song if you want.
Okay.
Because I think it's quite a radical song.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, it's about a cross-dressing vicar, but it challenges the very idea of what it means to cross-dress and a binary understanding of gender, because it is a non-judgmental song about someone who is eccentric and not abiding by the norms. Like, so the starting point is, I was pinching lead from the roof of a church. Like, so Morrissey's put himself in the song and he's out there and he's like, you know, stealing. So you've got that, like, very flawed protagonist in the story,
yeah.
And like you introduced to this vicar in a tutu, and you know he's not strange. He just wants to live his life this way, and it is a daft song. Like I'm not gonna argue with that, but I think it, in terms of like again the sort of queerness of Morrissey, and like he is an icon. He is a sort of, he does have that iconic status, but it's a song that's kind of daft and funny, but it's also celebrating weirdness. It's funny and it's happy. Why shouldn't the vicar wear a tutu, and why shouldn't we just be who we want to be? And like, even if we are a part of a Catholic church or whatever, like, so maybe that's my tremendously optimistic take on it. But that's how I feel about that song and why I quite like it.
But I guess as well, obviously, I mean, this was 1985, 1986, and I think that we've all kind of grown up a bit and moved on, and we're more accepting of things like kind of, you know, transgender and that sort of thing. I think before that, kind of reading some of the, it is a song that's been harshly critiqued over the years.
Yeah.
But I think that, like I say, when we're in this kind of, this brave new world where some of us at least are trying to be accepting of of everybody,
of course,
there is kind of a whole new meaning attached to it. Yeah. I know that Simon Price laid into this track. I don't have the quote in front of me actually, but he wasn't a fan of that one.
I could say that me and Simon could probably have a good little argument if we ever hang out. But
there was a site, the Lyrics and Songs Information Database, which is just like a mecca for Smiths fans interpreting the lyrics and stuff. And they, you know, more of a softer criticism, they'd say that the song grates after a while. Harming Side 2, if we were talking vinyl, of The Queen Is Dead. And I mean, again, it's funny.
It's kind of like
it's when you talk about it in that way. I don't view it in that way anymore. Yeah. You know, so it's. Well, I guess that's what's great.
Like I'm talking about it from my perspective, and for me, it is a joy to listen to the Smiths. I've been on like the biggest Smiths and Morrissey like binge for the past few months, and you know, just like, but I totally understand why people wouldn't like it, why people would think it's daft, and people would, and why it would grate. Like, you could make up an album of, you could make up a 5 out of 5 album from Smith's B-sides.
Yeah.
Like, the fact we're talking about this album and this collection of songs, it's not like this is a concept album with, like, but there are themes and narratives that run through it, and one of them is, like, Hooray for the Outsiders, and, like, you know, the outsiders should maybe inherit the earth, and like, we should ditch the bosses and we should ditch the monarchy and we should just put our tutus on if we want to, or, you know, go to the graveyard because we don't want to hang out in the sun. And like, you know, it's a song for people who feel weird and are weird, and like an album for that kind of stuff. So it's also just funny. When I was at uni, so years ago now, I was in Manchester and I was on a double-decker bus. And I went past, I'm not sure if it's the, but a Holy Name church in Manchester.
Right.
And I absolutely was like, and I think if I'd had a smartphone and if Twitter had existed then, I would have very much tweeted about it. But I just was like, but I was on my own, so I just kind of was like, is that the, is that, and then didn't Google it because I didn't have a smartphone in 2004 or whatever, but
So Johnny Marr, again with NME, said about the song, we had so many big songs, we thought it would be okay to come up with a couple of things that were a little more throwaway. Mm-hmm. It's not one of my favourites, but it was a laugh. It made a change from trying to change the fucking world.
Yeah.
And I guess that's, you know, and it made me think when he put it in that context, I thought, and again, we're going back to Queen slightly, but Queen released an album in 1991 called Innuendo, and it was the last album that they released before Freddie passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a track on the album called Delilah, and it's literally just a song about his cat.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bit where it's like, then you make me slightly mad when you pee all over my Chippendale suite. And people were just like, why the hell is Freddie Mercury singing a song about his cat when there's other tracks on the album which are talking about like mortality and all the themes that obviously he was exploring when he was kind of struggling with HIV and AIDS. Yeah. So it instantly made me think that sometimes it's okay just to move away from something. You know, it's all right to sing about your cat or sing about a vicar in a tutu.
Yeah, like, what's people's beef? Like, give over, like... I don't know. Like, that's great. Why shouldn't you sing about a cat?
Exactly.
I love cats.
Well, there's three running around here as we record, so if there's any background noise going on, that's very likely what it is. The next track on the album is There Is a Light That Never Goes Out.
Yeah.
So this wasn't actually released as a single in the UK until 1992.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I believe it was actually released in France to promote the album, but I'd have to double check that.
Mm-hmm.
Due to a legal dispute with Rough Trade, there was actually 9 months between the release of The Boy With The Thorn In His Side and the next single on the album.
Alright, okay.
Now, Jeff Travis, our Mr. Shankly, wanted There Is A Light That Never Goes Out to be the single, whereas Johnny Marr preferred Big Mouth Strikes Again.
Right, okay.
Do you have kind of a preference over it? Do you think that they made the right choice?
I think that There Is A Light That Never Goes Out is possibly the greatest pop song ever written.
So, yeah.
So, if I was picking a single, I'd go with Jeff Travis's, I'd go with Mr. Shankly's choice, but you know, at the same time, like, singles are singles
for a
reason. And but yeah, I cannot overstate. And that is such a, like, obvious choice of, like, favourite Smith song.
Mm-hmm.
But I went through my phase of picking a slightly obscure one, a sort of deep cut one, and I'm just like, no, that song is absolutely, as a pop song, it is absolutely perfect. It is, yeah, like, I'm sure a million people have said a million things about it, but for me, it is one of the greatest songs ever written.
And I don't think there's ever been a more... You were talking about double-decker buses, which is quite ironic. I don't think there's ever been a more romantic image of being hit by a double-decker bus.
Yeah.
It's this idea of, it's like, well, if it's going to happen, you know, I want it to be with you. And there's, you know, it's morbid, but, like, extremely romantically poetic at the same time.
It encapsulates that feeling that some of us have as teenagers and some of us still have in our 30s of that, like, sort of indescribably intense passion and, like, sort of longing, love, that is, like, I would do anything for you. not make love, but, yeah, like, that kind of... And to do that in that, like, rhyming couplet, it's like... This is dark, and this is like, I see this, and I know it's over, as like sister songs.
Yeah.
They're siblings on the album, and like, you know, like maybe I Know It's Over would have been better placed 9, and There Is A Light That Never Goes Out would have been better placed 3. There's layers to it that I'm still finding, even now, 15 years after first hearing the album. Yeah. So, but yeah, like, it is absolutely, absolutely brilliant song. I love it.
So the final track on the album is Some Girls Are Bigger Than Others.
Is this another one he doesn't like?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
We'll get to that.
No, yeah.
So engineer Stephen Street claims that he increased the reverb on the drums, that he faded the track in and then out again. So there's this noticeable kind of fade out and back in at the start of the song. Yeah. And then took the reverb off when reintroducing the song. Bit like opening a door, closing it, opening it again and walking in.
Yeah.
So that's his take on it. However, journalist Roddy Ashworth has suggested that kind of production technique was often employed to the record company so they couldn't use it without paying the band, that they would need like an unspoiled version almost.
Right, okay.
And that the album was rushed out because of the disputes between the Smiths and Rough Trade, that they didn't fully listen to the master properly.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just a bit of a tidbit. I'm just, it could be one or the other. Who knows?
But I mean, like, that's interesting. But that's one thing that I love about that song that I've never heard another song do, ever.
Yeah.
Is... It comes in quite quickly. It sort of fades in, And then it fades back out again. And you're like, what the hell? And you're like, the first time I heard it, I was like, that's wrong.
It's like, is my CD broken?
Exactly. And then it fades back in. It's like, I don't know. It's like a bit sort of, a bit of a gag, isn't it? It's a bit of musical comedy, maybe, or just a weird eccentricity, whichever way. Whether it was deliberate or just part of them rushing it out, I think it's I like that.
But I think it's somewhat in spirit with the song as well, because the song, you know, you've had this album full of poetic and sometimes haunting lyrics, and this song's very simple and it's pretty comedic. I mean, even it talks about Cleopatra and Antony. It's not even talking about the historical figures.
Yeah.
It's talking about the characters in Carry On Cleo.
Yeah,
you know, and it's. Yeah, I mean, it's a track, as we've alluded to at the start there, that has divided opinion among critics. So we'll get to Simon Price now. So I might be guilty, I must say, of only finding the critical parts of the article.
Mm-hmm.
He is a Smiths fan and he praises a lot of the album, but it's just that his criticism was so interesting and it was so biting on these particular songs. So he calls some girls the moment where it all goes tits up.
Right.
So... Again, I mean, I have a feeling I know what you're going to say. Is that harsh criticism of the song, and how does it do in terms of finishing the album?
Well, it fits perfectly with his. I can see what he likes from the Smiths, and like the three he doesn't like are the three funny songs on the album. This is one, whereas the other two funny ones I like.
Mm-hmm.
This is the one that I would say is the other, not low point, but this. So in the same way that the atmosphere of Never Had No One Ever just lets you sit for a while and kind of chill, this is kind of like, okay, this is the sort of pick me up before you go kind of thing.
Yeah.
Just like, and it is a kind of silly, maybe a bit problematic song, but I don't like, I don't know, like he's written about, like Morrissey has a solo song called You're the One for Me, Fatty. I don't know if you've ever heard that song.
Right.
But this is a lyrical theme that he has. And on the one hand, you could say, like, it's offensive. But on the other hand, you could say, this is Morrissey singing love songs to people who, you know, for whatever, who, like, this isn't the normal figure that's in a love song or whatever. So maybe again I'm being optimistic, but I see it as a celebration of diversity and a celebration but it is just a daft song that is like, I wouldn't defend it to the hilt or anything. And if someone came and said, nah, that's offensive, I'd say fair enough, whatever.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, it is a silly way to win the album.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's obviously, as I said, you spend the album taking in and interpreting all these lyrics, and then to use a phrase I hate, I feel like they're like trolling me a bit.
But so the caveat is
that
Send Me the Pillow, the One That You Dream On,
mm-hmm.
is one of the best last lines of a song.
Mm.
And like it brings it back up, I think, is like,
yeah,
Send Me the Pillow, the One That You Dream On, and I'll send you mine.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, so like, so it is a kind of a bit of a daft song, but there's still like that poetry that's just wrapped in it, and he can have a line like that in a song that, you know, like, I hope I could write a line that good, but he's just got so many coming out of him at that point that he's just, you know, that line is like the last line of the album, and the way that it kind of goes into that dreaminess, Send Me the Pillow, the One That You Dream On, and I'll send you mine, is like, great way to end the album. So I accept some of your man's criticism, but still a banging album.
Absolutely. And I mean, we've discussed some of that criticism thrown at the album, but on the whole, the assessment is, and it's the reason we're covering it, that the album is a truly classic album and it's one of the greatest of all time. 30 years on, and I know that some people who ask this hate this question, do you believe the album has stood the test of time?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course I do. I think, like, the Smiths are... You listen to something else that's from 1984 or 5.
Mm.
Like, again, I'm like, it's not my intention to bash other kinds of music, but they are a singular sound and a singular band that have been imitated, but no one's come even close. And, you know, part of that is because they're so weird sounding.
Mm.
And so it's... I put it with... If you watch a Stanley Kubrick film, from the 70s or 80s, it looks, it has a timelessness to it.
Yeah.
And if you put a Smiths record on, there's a timelessness to it. Like, yes, the production, some of the sort of guitar effects, the sort of, it's clearly being recorded with analog, you know, maybe some like proto digital like tools or whatever, but in terms of like the sound and the music and lyrics and yeah, everything about it is timeless for me. Yeah, so I think it's definitely, a lot of it was recorded while in the winter of 1985, which is when I was born. And I think like there's that, it's like this cultural product that kind of was born when I was as well. Yeah. And I've kind of got that kind of weird connection to it as well. I'm a bit obsessed with 80s stuff, which maybe everyone's obsessed with the era that they just missed. But I would have loved to have been there at the time to have seen them and stuff like that.
Do you think that the band's kind of resistance to reforming, which we've been talked about a little earlier, I mean, pretty much everyone else has at some point gone on a reunion tour or released an album. But do you think the fact that they haven't kind of keeps the album a bit special and a bit kind of...
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's the argument against doing the whole reforming thing. I think it's different for different bands, but the fact that, you know, Mike Joyce took Morrissey and Marr to court for £1 million each probably means that if they did reform, it wouldn't be with him on drums. And, you know, the fact, well, there's, we could do a whole other podcast on my theories about the Morrissey and Marr relationship. There's a lot of Morrissey solo music and indeed a lot of Morrissey lyrics in the Smiths era that I think are about Marr. And I think that, you know, maybe it's a leap of, maybe it's a leap too far, but I think there was a deep affection between them that was part of what made them so special, but also what drove them apart. Like, and because, you know, people always think because Morrissey's such a sort of singular and divisive figure that he's the one who split the Smiths up, but it was Marr who left the Smiths, and Morrissey sees his solo work, he sees it all as one body of work. He classes it all together and he performs Smith's songs live.
Yeah.
I would forgive them if they needed the money or whatever and they wanted to get back together. I'd probably even go and see them.
Yeah.
But I don't think they should. I think it would... There's very few things that have that perfection, and those 5 years that they did as a band were perfect. And they should just leave it, keep it as it is.
Yeah. So finally... And again, I ask this to everyone at the very end, last question. Why is it your classic album and why would you recommend that people check it out?
So it's my classic album, I guess, because so much of it is tied into my biography, as I said at the beginning, or didn't say, but I've sort of talked about throughout my, you know, how it spoke to me as a teen and how it still does. And yeah, I wouldn't recommend The Smiths to everyone because I don't think, although I think they are very popular and very well-loved and mainstream in many ways, a lot of people are going to hate it. But, you know, that's what makes great music, I think. Like, someone should hate it somewhere for some reason. Otherwise, it's probably too bland. So, yeah, I think if you like highbrow, kind of stupid at times, witty, political, sad, depressing... uplifting, meta, intertextual lyrics that steal from all over the shop, then, and you like symphonic pop music with great drums and bass and guitar, then listen to The Smiths. Listen to The Queen Is Dead.
Awesome. Well, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time, for picking the album, and for sitting down with me and talking about it.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers.
Thanks once again to Nathan Stevens Griffin for joining me to discuss The Queen Is Dead. Nathan, of course, is part of Durham's own DIY pop band Martha, and their latest album, Blisters in the Pit of My Heart, was released on the 1st of July last year. The AVClub.com included Blisters in its top 20 albums of the year, and it's definitely a recommended listen. If you want to know more about the band or to buy the album, get yourself over to www.marthadiy.bandcamp.com. And that'll just about do it for this month's episode. Thanks very much for tuning in. Of course, next month's episode will be a special tribute to Fleetwood Mac's 1977 album, Rumours. which as well as being one of the best-selling albums of all time, also celebrates its 40th birthday in February. Neil O'Donoghue will be my special guest for the episode. Neil runs the Fleetwood Mac fan site Go Your Own Way, the UK resource for all things Fleetwood Mac, and it's a veritable feast of information for fans of the band. Don't forget that you can get involved in this episode in the usual ways. Send us your thoughts and memories of the album to Facebook, Instagram or Twitter. And my favourites, I'll end up on the show next month. So until then, I hope you have a great start to the new year, and I'll see you in February. Cheers!